Station number 1194.
It's on our Judge Jalan, Reel 11.
You were saying about the brain gunner and the sniper.
They were in an upstairs room at this farm, and we'd remembered our training. We'd broken the window deliberately. We'd broken all the windows in the upstairs rooms.
Put the grenade net over it?
No. But we'd we'd be using a table at the far end of the room, away from the window, so that we were not obvious, and it would not be obvious from where the shooting was coming. And they were firing away for most of the day at ground level, people we couldn't see. There were hedges and ditches and a sunken road along which German troops were moving. They were not firing at us, but we were able to mortar them with the 2-inch mortar. There was a lot of movement behind us during the day, and the engineers managed to get a pontoon bridge across the canal so that our supplies could come up. We were told that the 15th Lowland Scottish Division was on our side of the canal to our left, and that they would be linking up with us in due course. And during the day, our rations came up and we were all fed. At nightfall, we had stand to as usual, and it was during this period that the fighting started. The Germans mounted an attack, determined to drive us back across the canal. There was very heavy shelling and mortaring, and this was later added to by machine gun and tank gun fire. We were in a comparatively compact area, and the enemy was concentrating all its fire on our small bridgehead. In due course, things became very confused in the darkness, because it really was dark. Casualties were being suffered, and nobody really knew what was the main plan in such circumstances. We hadn't been told.
Because this had all been done in a rush, hadn't
yeah.
it? There'd been no
organisation at all. We'd only been there, we'd come across the night before, we'd been there one day getting settled in, and no old groups or anything of that kind.
But basically, if I can get the idea of it, you'd set up a battalion perimeter
yes.
on the far side of the canal.
Yes.
You got a line across the canal. Had you actually linked up with the 15th Scottish?
No.
You hadn't
never. We never did do.
The Germans had been over on your right when you crossed the canal, and then they started closing in on you in the night.
In the night.
Came down.
Yes. yes. And also, of course, what was important was that we had no armour at all across the canal. They were using armour, and everything became very, very confused. And we didn't know what was going on. Now, I made up my mind that it would be very stupid just to stay there in the bridgehead as a sitting target. But on the other hand, it was simply asking for trouble to try and get back to the pontoon bridge to get across that. And that bridge was obviously the main German's main target objective.
So they tried to pinch in.
They were trying to crush
canal.
Us. Yes.
Were they coming in from both sides?
Both sides and in front.
So they were trying to put you in a pocket then?
Yes. Or with the canal behind us. And the bridge. The pontoon bridge.
And were you in touch with the people on either side of you, on your own flanks?
Companies, only companies, nobody else.
Yes. But I mean, within the battalion, there was a continuous...
I imagine so, but nobody really knew what was happening. People were milling around and shooting and generally trying to get organised and keep organised. And because I didn't want to sit there as a sitting duck, I collected my own men together, and I also gathered some other people who apparently were lost. And then, in the darkness, we all set off, I suppose about 20 of us altogether. And we did not go back towards the bridge. Instead, we went in the opposite direction towards Giel and towards the enemy. We kept to the fields, but we soon discovered that the Germans were advancing along the roads on either side of us. and they were performing an operation that we'd never encountered before. It was an attack with tanks at night. And the tanks were moving along the roads, one behind the other. Each tank was being guided by a man on foot with a telephone, who was presumably saying the equivalent of left hand down, right hand down, to the tank driver. And each tank was it was escorted by about 20 or 30 infantrymen. They were obviously mounting a major attack. Now, it would have been foolish for us to engage such formidable forces. And so my group continued on our way until we were well behind the advancing enemy. We didn't know where we were. We didn't know what was happening to the rest of the people in the bridgehead. There was a tremendous amount of noise and a lot of milling around going on. Eventually we found a wood and we took up up positions around the edge of it. As dawn broke, the sounds of fighting died away, and we waited for daylight to discover what was happening.
These tanks that you saw, have you any idea what sort of tanks
Tigers.
They were?
They were using Tigers all the time at that stage. As far, there may have been some Panthers, but we'd chiefly come across Tigers.
They must have been moving very, very slowly if they'd got an infantryman leading them.
Oh, yes, they were going, and of course very quietly, because the great advantage that German tanks had was that you couldn't hear them at night. Their engines were so quiet that they could creep up. They used to creep along, and they had rubber treads on their tracks, and really they a very, very quiet engine, which is surprising. When they opened up, you could hear them, but they were able to creep up and through the darkness very well indeed.
Presumably, though, the German infantry accompanying them were close. They weren't actually scouting into the field.
Oh, no. They were going down the side of the road with them, in lines, and presumably following the tanks, ready to deal with the bridgehead when they got to it. Anyway, when dawn came, we were able to see what was happening. When we could see, we discovered to our surprise that we were behind an infantry unit about 150 yards away, and the unit had dug in and they were all facing the bridgehead, so they had the backs to us.
This was an enemy infantry.
Oh, yes, German. Our wood was next to a small farm adjacent to a road, and along this we heard a cart coming. It was being pushed by a detachment of German soldiers, who were obviously bringing up the rations for their men in their lines in front of us. There were about eight of them altogether, and when they reached us, we intercepted them and directed them into the farmyard and locked them all up in a barn. And we helped ourselves to some of their rations.
What was breakfast like then?
I don't bread, I suppose. I don't know now. Nothing.
Bread and coffee?
I'm not sure. It was. I can't remember now, but I know we ate some of it. And possibly some of the meat they liked so much. I don't know. Anyway, during the morning, we detained about 20 more of the enemy using the road in both directions. Every time they reached us, we sent them into the barn. Unfortunately, most of them seemed very, very happy to being discovered and taken prisoner in that way, being disarmed. They weren't at all hostile, we found.
How many of them were there?
Well, they were coming in twos and threes and fours and that sort of thing. They weren't organised. There were people going backwards and forwards, presumably runners, cooks, clerks, that sort of thing. They weren't organised platoons or sections.
Were they just an ordinary army infantry?
Yes, yeah. Anyway, at one stage, a small cart with some four or five very badly injured German soldiers in it was brought back along the road from the bridgehead by some medical personnel. They were pushing it and the wounded were on the cart. We looked at the situation and we discussed it, and eventually we took the risk of allowing the wounded to be taken back to their own reserve lines, and there was no adverse consequences to us, although we'd let them through.
Did they spot you then?
Oh, we saw them, we spoke to them.
And
we went and intercepted them.
You and intercepted them?
Yes. And spoke, and they asked could they take their wounded back, and we said yes. And during the morning, we saw some of our own men from the bridgehead being led away as prisoners. There were about 10 of them. And they were being led along a hedgerow on the far side of the field next to our wood. They had a substantial escort, and again, we had a discussion about the situation, and we felt that we couldn't afford to abandon our own prisoners in the barn, and if we attacked the escort, we'd give away our presence and would be outnumbered by the totality of Germans in the area. Apart altogether, of course, from the men we had as prisoners.
How many of those had you got by that time?
Well, 20, 30, 40.
They didn't try and break out of the barn then? They just...
Well, they didn't know what was happening. No, they were in there, and we put somebody outside with a gun or a rifle, and they were quite happy to sit there, wonder what was going to happen.
You say you had a discussion about this. Was this the whole body of men, or
no,
the NCOs?
No, all the NCOs, and what on the basis of what do you think we should do, Corporal so-and-so. And this became very, very, this discussion, I think, was very important as far as our prisoners of war being taken away was concerned, because I remember that I was minded to try and do something about it, and I would have... seriously considered starting shooting at the escort and so on, but it was at that stage that the bulk of opinion of the people with me came to the conclusion that we might miss, we wouldn't hit people, and of course the immediate reaction of the German escort would be to kill the prisoners.
And you might have hit your own people while you were shooting at the escort.
Yes, but I think it was chiefly we were afraid of the escort murdering the prisoners, as of course we knew happened on these occasions. And so we thought it was better to do nothing to rescue these 10 unfortunate prisoners of war. But we did learn later that at least some of them got home safely at the end of the war, and I think, in fact, most of them probably got back. But we didn't interfere with their situation as far as we were concerned. By mid-morning, the German unit in front of us started pulling out in an orderly fashion. They were about a company strong, and again, we did nothing to stop them. We let them go and lay low as they went past the farm. I'd sent scouts off to discover what was happening, and eventually we made contact with some of our own people who were now moving up to join us and go towards Giel. Apparently, the German attack had been repulsed with considerable casualties on both sides, and I was able to hand over all my prisoners, and we joined the advance in the town. The bridgehead had held. It was a very vicious engagement altogether, and indeed the Giel appears on the colour of the battalion as a result of that as a result of that incident. It was one of our battle honours. The town itself, Giel, was captured later that day in a very straightforward attack.
Is it strongly defended?
No, not by the time we got there. The whole incident as I'd been saying, it was a great, regarded as a battle honour on our colours, and I've always felt myself that our little group didn't disgrace themselves, and 30 to 40 prisoners and no casualties on our part wasn't a bad outcome. After Giel, our advance continued as we pushed on towards the flying bomb launching sites and the Dutch border. We were still in the role of lorried infantry and were therefore able to push on at a very reasonable speed. We were in high spirits, which with occasional skirmishing, and reports from every front were very encouraging. The whole of the Allied armies were on the move and were winning. It was at that stage that there was one incident when we intercepted a German motorcycle and sidecar. The driver, the rider, was killed. And we looked in his sidecar and we found it was were supplies for, obviously, for an officer's mess. And everybody helped themselves to tins of chicken and turkey and ham and salt fish and various other canned goods. And I'm afraid that as a result of that incident, I obtained a taste for Benedictine, which was my prize, which has lasted me ever since. I can't recall any outstanding incidents during that period until we came to Operation Market Basket, an airborne attack on Arnhem. And we'd crossed into Holland, it's a village called something like Falkensward.
Falkensward, yeah. There's an airfield there.
Ah. Well, yes, I didn't know there.
So you didn't notice any air activity or anything like that? Did you notice any change when you crossed into the...
Oh, yes. It was very, very interesting because Belgium in that area is somewhat drab. It's uninteresting and the people were very enthusiastic, but the people were very enthusiastic in their welcome of us. We still collected flowers and fruit and drink and cake wherever we stopped, although the wretched population were heavily rationed at the time. But in Holland, the houses and villages appeared to be less drab, the paint on the buildings looked new, the gardens looked well cared for, very neat, and the washing seemed to us to be extra white and bright, blowing in the wind, and clotheslines. The people there were far less demonstrative in their welcoming than the French and Belgians had been. They smiled and clapped and waved, but seemed somewhat reserved, and we knew that they were really very pleased to see us, but that they were rather like the English people and were not at ease in showing their feelings and emotions. We grew to like and admire the Dutch very much indeed. They were kindness itself, often inviting us in their own homes, and they'd had a terrible time during the occupation. It was, in fact, at that stage that I heard for the first time the observation that if an Englishman were not English, then he would like to be Dutch. And there was no doubt about the rapport which existed between ourselves and the Dutch community as soon as we arrived. Now, it was about that stage that I was removed from the battalion. I was still, of course, a platoon commander because of casualties. With the senior, more senior officers, I had acted as company commander on occasions, but every time when I hoped that I was going to be promoted, somebody was produced from England of senior rank to take a command of the company. And as a result, I went up and down from platoon commander, second in command, and company commander. Only to lose it all at the end because a more senior person was posted out. I found this aspect of the matter particularly trying because the people who came very largely knew far less about fighting than I did. And some of them had wild theories, perhaps battle school schemes which they thought they'd put into operation. But in effect were not terribly effective. I had a number of quarrels with my new company commanders. One company commander came and he put my batman on a charge, Arthur Atkinson, who'd been with me ever since Sicily. He put him on a charge because his boots weren't cleaned. and that was within a few hours of his arriving. I never liked that company commander, and I wasn't at all sorry when in due course he got his comeuppance by being wounded, although he still survived today. He was wounded in the leg. But we had that sort of thing caused me a lot of disappointment, and I was dissatisfied with my position in that regard. I was also very concerned that because I was so experienced, I was very often used for these night patrols. I did a lot of patrolling, and I think I was regarded as being one of the good ones. And as a result, I was called on far more often than I should have been, looking back. And as a result, sorry.
Having done the sniping course, then presumably you would have been regarded as an expert in field craft.
Oh, yes. Yes. But as a result of all this, I'd also become lonely, because by this time I was the very last rifle company officer left in the brigade. There had been, or the strength of the battalion at that stage, officer strength, was about 34, 35. We could count through our battalion since D-Day, and it was all since D-Day, over 130 officers who had been through and had become casualties. I had, of course, friends in the support companies, the support platoons and so on, and sections, and the quartermaster and the mortar officer and so on. They were there, but for actual rifle company officers, I was the last one in the brigade. And I was very conscious of the fact that the way things were going, I was going to be the next one who was going to be wounded. Anyway, I think, in fact, the stress and strain, which must have been showing by that time, and a very kindly Major Chambers, George Chambers, who was acting CO, decided that I should be given a rest, and I therefore was taken out of my platoon and sent to brigade headquarters as a liaison officer. I was a lieutenant, and I think I was LO2, was my official rank. Major Chambers said that he was, I remember when he said goodbye to me, he said that he was doing this in order to make sure that I would be preserved as an exhibit in the regimental museum after the war. Anyway, I went to 151 Brigade Headquarters, and I was there during the Operation Market Basket and the Arnhem affair.
On this question of stress, were you yourself conscious of an increase in attention?
Oh yes. There was a feeling of the on occasions one felt the strain, particularly out patrolling. And it became very, very strong, in a very strong feeling indeed, that it was getting bomb happy, as we said.
Did you actually ever suffer any physical symptoms as a result of?
No. Not that I'm aware of. I may have been wild-eyed and so on, but I'm not conscious of it. And I'm not conscious that it had any effect on my men. I'm not conscious that people were treating me as an invalid. It was just the case that I was getting a bit shrill, perhaps, and because, after all, it had been quite a long time.
The psychologists say that it is precisely at the level you are at, which is platoon commanding level, that the stress is actually strongest.
Oh, it must be, because after all, they're at the sharp end, and our attitude was that the platoon commander always went first. He didn't send men in front of him, and he couldn't ask the men to do things that he wasn't prepared to do himself, and as a result, that if people were tired and a job came up, the platoon commander would say, well, I'll do it, in effect, and take one or two volunteers with him.
What about amongst the men? Did you notice that I mean, there must have been a turnover in the platoon as well.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, were there any men who'd been in the platoon all the way through who were showing signs of strain as a result?
Not that I'm aware of, because our casualties were quite heavy. We had a good turnover of men. I'm thinking now of my own Batman, who'd been with me all that time. He was a very calm sort of man, a Geordie bit man, and very good. No doubt he saved my life many times, and I never had to ask him to go with me on a patrol. He regarded himself as my personal bodyguard, and if I was sent out, I never had to ask him to go. He took it for granted that he was going. And we were very good friends. Anyway.
So Major Chambers decided you needed a rest, presumably because he wanted to preserve your effectiveness.
Oh, yes. Well, perhaps he'd been kind. Because, of course, if you get to that stage, mistakes occur. And one of the things I'm very proud of, and perhaps I shouldn't be, but I'm very proud of the fact that, as far as I'm aware, I was never responsible for any injury or death of any of my men. I never made a mistake of the kind that sometimes did occur, where people misjudged the situation. And I'm very grateful to that, because it would be my conscience otherwise.
You mentioned that there was a succession of company commanders came out, some of whom were not competent because they had no experience of fighting. And you said that some of them had peculiar ideas they picked up in battle schools.
Yeah.
This is a very common sort of comment on the product of battle schools.
Oh, yes.
Peculiar ideas did they have?
Well, one man, for example, this was not at this stage, by the way. This is going back to the bocage now.
Yes.
We had one company commander who came along. He was a major. He came from the Northamptons, I think. I won't mention his name. But we were held up at one stage for some time, and we were held up with a small field in the Bocage country, and there was a spando in each corner, the opposite corners, and they were firing crossfire across this land. And this particular company commander came along and wanted to know what was holding me up. And I said that we had two spandos and that was that. And he said, oh, he said, you don't need to worry about that. All you need to deal with is a couple of spandos or eight determined men with fixed bayonets. And I said to him, well, I'm not prepared to go, and I'm not prepared to take any of my men, but if you want to, you'll get your volunteers and you'll try it, and we'll give you all the covering fire you can. And to my surprise, he went. And he brought up some wretched men from a reserve platoon somewhere, and they started scrambling through the hedge towards machine guns, and we opened up with all our Bren guns, and we put smoke down, and HE, where we thought the Germans were. And the result was very sad. I think nearly all the men were hurt. And the company commander himself was wounded, and we had to go out then and get them in, which again was extra trouble. We had another incident with one of these company commanders. He was another major. He'd only been with us a few days, and that was in Belgium. He ordered me to take my platoon across open country to a crossroads in the fields immediately in front, and to hold the crossroad. It's very flat country, there was no cover at all. And as we were talking and he was telling me where to go, which way to route to take, I noticed the smoke shells drop in the area of this crossroad, and one shell went behind the crossroads, and the other shell, second shell, went behind our side of it, or in front of the crossroad. And it was quite obvious to me that the 74th Field were ranging on this particular crossroads. It was going to be one of their targets, a set target. And so I said that I had no intention of taking my men into there because they were ranging on it. He refused to accept my view. He told me that I would go and that he would have me court-martialed if I didn't. And that was that. So I went. And we more or less got almost onto the crossroads. And the 74th Field opened up. And they stomped the area well and truly. And casualties as a result of this major. And when I got back to the company headquarters, the company commander stood there crying his eyes out, saying how sorry he was.
What happened to him?
He was killed later. Two or three days later, he was hit by a shell. But he was no, I'm sorry, but he was no loss as far as we were concerned. But this was the sort of thing which was unsettling to rifle company officers, to be put in charge of people who didn't know what they were doing. It was all theory, and it was all bravado.